Okay, hello and welcome for Computer Graphics. So let me first of all make a short announcement that's maybe interesting for you because we have an exchange program with Brazil, in particular with the University of Curitiba. It's an exchange program for students starting in the fifth semester. So yeah, that's probably just the group that is attending this lecture, fifth semester of bachelor or master studies in computer science or medical engineering or also other study programs. But it's explicitly, or the priority is for computer science and for medical engineering because we applied for these students for it. But also other students are welcome to hand in an application. To give you a little impression of Curitiba, our partners in Brazil prepared some slides. So Curitiba is in, Brazil is in general very big. And Curitiba is here in the very south, so it means it's not as hot as you might expect it to be from Brazil. It's on the southern hemisphere, so right now it's summer there. Within Curitiba, it's rather close to the to the coast, not directly at the coast, but close to the coast in the region of Paraná. And Curitiba is a very modern and very safe city. Yeah, so it's not as you might expect Brazil to be, very well organized. They have very good public transport. About 2 million people are living there, so it's not a small city. Very European. There are very many European immigrants there, and we have a rather long-going exchange with them. So it's not the first round. We do that for quite some time, so we know the partners in Brazil rather well. It's well established how you can exchange ECTS credit points that you get there, how to also include them into your studies. The computer science department there is definitely not small, 36 professors. They have courses for computer science, biomedical informatics. Their focus is computational intelligence, information technology, computer networks, embedded systems. So they have interesting stuff that you can hear there. Courses are in general in Portuguese, but it's clear that obviously not too many of our students probably speak Portuguese, but so they make it possible also for foreign students to attend these lectures by providing English slides or stuff like that, and everything can also be done in English. And in fact, even our German our partners there speak German very well. Two of them even have a German passport. So communication and so on is really well organized and works well. You get the program. You get money for the flight there and for living and so on. So it's definitely possible to live from the scholarship there and also to see a little bit, and not only to spend the time in Curitiba. If you're interested, contact me, maybe directly after the lecture, or you can also, and this is now here again, on this slide, you can directly contact Roberto Grosso. Here you can see the email address and he can give you more information about what you need to apply. So we are right now speaking about exchanges that will happen in the second half next year, August to December next year. Okay, good. So that was a non-computer graphics related announcement. Maybe it's interesting for you, or rather, I would say it's a really it's a cool way to be in a country where you otherwise wouldn't go to. Yeah, and Curitiba definitely is a city where I don't have problems to send students. Because it's safe and so on. But it's very different, and it's a really interesting place to go to. Okay, good. So back to computer graphics. We were speaking about texture mapping, and so on Monday, I told you about different possibilities, what we can do with textures. So we can use textures as kind of wallpapers that we glue onto images, onto objects, but we can also do things like normal mapping, or we also looked into 3D textures and so on. But one thing we ignored in some sense up to now is we learned how we map texture coordinates from our triangles or from our objects. Now how we compute these texture coordinates. And I always said, okay, we use this ST then to read the texture. Yeah, but how exactly is that done? Yeah, and there are a few interesting things that we should consider with this respect. And this is essentially what we will look into today. And we will also look into these aliasing artifacts that I was already showing you in the demo on Monday, where with this checkerboard pattern, very random patterns in the background appeared. And this is a very significant and interesting problem. And we will also look into this because it also implies that we need to take special care how to map texture coordinates to corresponding texture values. Okay, so first of all, the probably easiest problem to solve is what happens if we have texture coordinates outside 0, 1. So up to now, we say, okay, our texture coordinates are values between 0 and 1, or at least our texture is addressed by coordinates between 0 and 1 from the unit square. But maybe you remember in the demo, we also had that infinite tiling of an infinite plane. Yeah, and there the texture is repeated very often. And I told you that this works by simply taking texture coordinates larger than 1. Yeah, so we can directly take the x and y coordinates, for instance, as texture coordinates. And then just take the fractional part of the texture coordinate to access the texture. And in fact, that's this mode here, which is called repeating. And here the idea is that in general, before we address a texture with texture coordinates ST, we take the fractional part of S and T and use this to access our texture. And by this, automatically textures can be repeated. Yeah. So that's why it is called repeating. Another alternative is to use clamping. And here the idea is that simply S and T, if they are larger than 1 or smaller than 0, then they are just clamped to these values. Yeah. So that means that the last column, row, or first column and first row is sort of stretched or repeated to the outside. Yeah, so here we can see such a clamping result. And there are different applications where one or the other is the choice, what you usually want to have. Repeating works, if you remember that floor example, that infinite floor, where we take one floor texture with wood, for instance, and then put it next to each other. That only works if the texture is such that if you put the textures next to each other, often you see the seam, but some textures you can download, for instance, are seamless in the sense if they are glued together like this, then you don't see the seam, or at least the transition is by some post-processing with Photoshop or so is much less visible. Yeah, so that's what's called a tileable texture. Yeah. So with tileable textures and repeating, you just can tile arbitrary large areas. Okay, good. So that's rather simple. Yeah, so we don't have to worry about that a lot. Then there's another thing, and this is normally our texture coordinates, of course, won't be integer, even if we transform them to pixel coordinates. Yeah, so in general, we will have a situation that we have texture positions here by these orange dots. Yeah, and our ST coordinates will be somewhere in between. Yeah, so only very rarely they will directly hit such a pixel center. Yeah, so we need a way now to compute a color for such a point. Yeah, and I mean, from other lectures, probably you have ideas what we can do. Bilinear interpolation will be probably the best choice to go there. But there's also another option, which is called nearest neighbor. That's just the simplest way to do. And here the idea is that in that case, for instance, yeah, we just take the value of the nearest texture sample. Yeah, in that case, if we have a texture value, want to evaluate it here, we just take this color value. Yeah, so that's nearest neighbor. Very simple formula. Yeah, so we just round this pixel position and take the corresponding color. So as a result, if we have this 2x2 texture, for instance, yeah, and map it onto that square, we get this result. Yeah, so you can still see the single pixels. And the alternative is bilinear interpolation. And this is the typical way to do interpolation on a rectangular grid. And this formula is a little bit more complicated. Yeah. So these essentially are the distances to the single texels in x and y direction, and bilinear interpolation, yeah, here then interpolates the four surrounding values, Cij, Ci plus 1j, Cij plus 1, and Ci plus 1j plus 1. So in that example, it interpolates between these four values, and the interpolation depends on this distance and on this distance. Yeah, so the yeah, component-wise distance to the samples. Yeah, for that example, we get this interpolation here. So you see the pixel borders sort of disappear, yeah, and we get some smooth interpolation of that texture. And yeah, the texel boundaries or the boundaries of the single pixels of the textures are smoothed out, but of course, if you do a large magnification, you can still recognize it. Yeah, it's just blurred a little bit, so it's not that well visible. But of course, yeah, at some point you can see the single pixels anyhow. Okay, so here we see two examples from that demo that I've already also shown. So there we have two different textures. Two different such checkerboard textures. The first one is an 8x8 texture, or both are 8x8, but here the checkerboard looks like this, so every other pixel is black or white, yeah? And if we do nearest neighbor interpolation, we get this checkerboard. So maybe for a checkerboard renderer, nearest neighbor is what you want, because if we use bilinear interpolation, we get this pattern here, yeah? And this doesn't really look like a checkerboard anymore. So here we have another checkerboard texture, and here you see the 8x8 texture is only subdivided into four fields or four squares. Yeah? And if we do nearest neighbor interpolation, we get this, and with bilinear interpolation, we still or better can see now the single fields here, yeah, but the boundaries are still blurred. Yeah. Okay, just to a little bit show the difference and explain why we have these two different checkerboards in that texture demo, to see that difference. Okay, so that's interpolation. I mean, yeah, that's rather obvious that we want to do something like that. Bilinear interpolation is probably or sometimes also not really optimal because, yeah, it's a rather simple interpolation scheme. Sometimes people thought about higher order interpolation, that we do not only take the four surrounding pixel values, but a larger region to get even smoother interpolation of the values. That's possible, but it never really worked out, or in practice, I think it's hardly ever used, yeah, because it's much more computationally expensive, and the benefit probably is not worth it, or only in rare cases. Okay, good. So, that was interpolation. And in fact, now let's look at this example of our checkerboard that we've seen very often up to now. Yeah. And in this example, we see now different effects. And maybe let's first look at the easy region. That's this region here in the front. Yeah. So what happens here is texture magnification. That means if we look at single pixels of our texture, they are larger than the pixels on our screen. Yeah. So if we look at one of these, at this black square, for instance, yeah, obviously it covers multiple pixels on our screen. Yeah. That's texture magnification. And yeah, magnification has the disadvantage that we see the texture pixels. Yeah. Obviously, the texture resolution is not sufficient in that case. Yeah, we are so close that we can see the texture pixels. We can reduce artifacts a little bit by this interpolation that we've seen before. Yeah, so this interpolation here, these interpolation schemes are in particular interesting in the texture magnification region. Yeah. Here in the front. Here we can see the difference, mainly see the difference what kind of interpolation we do. But if we go more and more to the back, we get to a range where we have texture minification. And that now means that single pixels of the texture, which by the way are called texels, yeah, so that our texels are smaller than a pixel. Or the other way around, within a single pixel of our image, there are multiple texels. Yeah? So if we would zoom in here in the background, we have something like this, yeah, that we have a single pixel of our image and the grid. Now has multiple texels within one pixel. Yeah? And in fact, this is a very interesting and not so simple problem, because what happens here now is that usually, yeah, if we just evaluate our texture at the center of our pixel, yeah, as we most often do it, yeah, then in this case, we see a white field, a white square in our texture, but you can imagine that if the texture only moves slightly, a little bit, we suddenly see a white one. Yeah, and in fact, if the pixels are rather small, it is almost random whether our pixel center is right now in a black or in a white square. So the color we obtain is sort of random. Yeah. And this generates this flickering in the background that we've seen in the demo. I can briefly go back to that. I mean, I've already shown you. Yeah? So we take our typical square, we make it infinite, yeah, and then we can already see that here. And if I go a little bit further up to make things even worse, yeah, you can see that in the background, yeah, we really have sort of a random pattern. I hope you can. Yeah, and it's not even not only random, but it's even worse. Yeah, if I move around, yeah, it's randomly flickering. Yeah. Okay, but if we look at that, we also see another interesting effect, and that is we do not only see random patterns, but sometimes we see new structures like this here. And these rings here, yeah, And we can see them from time to time. And if we rotate, yeah, these structures change. Oh, yeah, so that's probably an impressive thing, yeah? So we get very weird patterns, yeah? And this is another type of artifact that appears in the background. And even if we turn on here for, you see, for texture magnification, we can turn on filtering, yeah? So now here in the front, things look smoother, but obviously we can exactly here see the boundary where we switch from magnification to minification, yeah? And this filtering in the minification area doesn't help at all. Okay, so we should think about something, yeah? How can we handle texture minification? And how can we get rid of these weird artifacts in these regions, which are called aliasing? And maybe you remember we were already speaking about aliasing when we spoke about rasterization. Yeah, rasterization of lines. If we rasterize lines, we have the problems that these lines, due to the pixel grid, yeah, we can only represent them by such stair cases, yeah, so by such stair patterns, which we also call jaggies. Yeah? And if our pixels are not very small, we can see these staircases. And this is what we called aliasing. And we saw that we can reduce aliasing by also by making the line a little bit thicker and also use gray values. Yeah? And depending on how much of a pixel is covered or how close the line is to a particular pixel to decide about its gray value. And so we can smooth out this boundary a little bit, yeah, and get nicer results. Now here today, what we will speak about texture aliasing, which is a variant of aliasing, yeah, but the context is a little bit different, but in fact it's all problems that appear from undersampling. Yeah, we have some continuous function and we sample it at a few positions. Yeah, that's all we can afford. This results can result in problem if the function has very high variation, yeah, and we sample it at a few points, yeah, all the information in between is lost. Yeah, and if the function has high variation, then we have a problem. And this is called aliasing. And in fact, these patterns, I mean, here we can a little bit subdivide this range here. Yeah, so we can say here in the texture magnification range, we are fine. Then we have here some range where we see these weird patterns. Yeah, so suddenly we see new frequencies. We see new patterns that are not there in the original texture. And then we have a range here where we have complete randomness, but in fact, I mean, these ranges are the same. It's just that these aliasing patterns here are so high frequency that we cannot really realize them, but we see them as random. Yeah, so this is the region into which we will look into now. And to understand what's going on, yeah, we will first only look at scan lines. Yeah, so we will look at a 1D variant of our problem, and later on we will then transfer this to 2D. So, yeah, let's look at a particular scan line. Yeah, so one line here in that image, one line, and now let's say we have a texture, yeah, that looks like this. So it's a kind of color checkerboard. So we first have a blue pixel, then a white one, a red one, a white one, and a green pixel. Yeah. So this is our texture. And now we map this texture to our scan line and we map it with different scalings. Yeah. And what we have here is that the texels, yeah, this blue box is a texel, one pixel of our texture. And this grid here is the current scan line, and here you can see the single pixels. And we compute the color of a pixel by determining the color at the center of this pixel. Yeah, so these are these little circles here. So these are the positions, These lines are the positions where we sample the texture. Yeah, and in that example, yeah, for that line, our texels are larger than our pixels. So as a result, this pixel sees blue. This pixel sees blue. Yeah, even if here it's starting to get white, but we only sample at the center. Yeah, so this pixel sees blue, this one white, red, white, white, green, and this is the resulting image. Yeah, here we can see a blue pixel, blue, blue, white, white, red, white, white, green. And of course, yeah, due to the sampling, yeah, we don't have a perfect reproduction of the texture. Yeah, so for instance, here the red, yeah, the red part only gets one pixel and the blue part gets two pixels. But nevertheless, at least we see all the single texels. Nothing gets lost. Yeah? Just because the texels, yeah, are larger than our pixels. Yeah? So that's the magnification range. Yeah? That's the okay range. And now we can think, when does it become critical? Obviously, an interesting point is when pixels and texels have exactly the same size. Yeah, so that's a certain line in our image. Yeah, so at a certain height, the texels have exactly the same size as the pixels. And that's perfect. Yeah, because now the first pixel sees blue, then we see white, then we see red, white, green, white, yellow, white. Yeah, now we have a perfect one-to-one relation between pixels and texels. Yeah, so that's good. Yeah, that's the perfect point. Yeah, but it's only one line in our image. And above that line, now the texture becomes smaller. The texels are smaller than single texels, pixels. Yeah, like this here. You see now we repeat the texture because we have many more texels now. But what happens now? Yeah, that pixel sees white. The red pixel is skipped, then we see white again. Green is skipped, we see white. Yellow is skipped, we see white. Blue is skipped. Blue is skipped, white is skipped, then we see red, and so forth. And this is the result. Yeah. And here in that area, we have one complete sequence of blue, red, green, and yellow has been skipped and has been replaced by something completely white. Yeah? Just because we have about half the size here, yeah, so with our sampling pattern, we always hit the white fields. Yeah? And this, of course, now is very bad. Yeah? This is a very bad reproduction. Yeah? And here, all blue, all color in that region here is missed. Yeah? This is texture minification, because the texture pixels are smaller than our screen pixels. Okay, so yeah, it's very similar to that one, but only looking at a particular line. Yeah, if we take that one and we look at that line, within that line we have white, black, and if we sample, we sort of randomly see white at this place, yeah, but if we move it a little bit, we would see black. Okay, good. So how can we understand that? And now we come to a theory that some of you probably know. If not, I will try to explain it, and if you already know it, then maybe it helps to get another explanation. This is essentially the sampling theorem. And what we do for now is that, yeah, as I already said, we are looking at scan lines, at single lines, yeah, so we look at it as a 1D problem. And instead of checkerboard textures, we look at sine waves. Yeah, it has a good reason, because later on we will look into Fourier analysis, and this works with sine waves. So let's now say our texture is a sine wave, yeah? And now magnification, the okay range, now means that our sine wave has a frequency or a wavelength, let's say that's the distance between two peaks that is larger than the pixel grid. Yeah, so in that case, you see, yeah, we have this sample, this sample, this sample, this sample, and so forth. Yeah, again, these lines are the pixel grid, or in fact, it's the pixel samples. Yeah, so the pixel, the pixel boundaries are in between. So these are the places where our pixels sample that texture. The texture is the sine wave. Yeah, and we get these samples. And if we only look at these samples, yeah, and kind of fit a smooth curve through it, we can rather well reconstruct that sine wave. It won't be a perfect sine wave, yeah, but we can reconstruct that rather well, because we have too bright, too dark, too bright, dark, yeah, we can see that change from bright to dark. The boundary case, yeah, is that one. Now every pixel, yeah, always sees here the maximum of that function, and the next one the minimum, maximum, minimum, maximum, minimum. Yeah, so we at least see the oscillation. And if again we fit a curve, we can sort of reproduce, yeah, and we still see all the detail of the texture. Okay, but the bad thing now is here, if we make the pixel grid even wider, yeah, I mean, in fact, we should make the texture signal denser, but that's more difficult to paint, to draw. Yeah, so we make relative the pixel width grid wider, and we now sample that function, we get these points. And if you look at these points now, they look like a new sine wave, but a different sine wave, yeah, obviously with a different frequency, which is a little bit weird, yeah, but in fact, it explains these weird patterns that we have here, yeah? Because these are frequencies that are not in the original signal. It's a high frequency, yeah, with too few samples that suddenly shows up as such a new frequency, yeah, transferred to this checkerboard. That means suddenly we see larger larger squares, yeah, because we see another frequency here. Or we see another sine wave. Okay, good. So, yeah, again, we kind of a little bit understood what's going on. And to describe that mathematically, we will use a tool, that is very, very powerful. And very often you will hear arguments about images and their frequency content, for instance, yeah, which is a way to describe how an image looks like. And that is all based on Fourier analysis. Okay, let's make it the positive way. Who knows what Fourier analysis is? Yeah, okay, good. So it makes sense to explain it again, right? I will make it very superficial, yeah, and leave out all the math part. The idea of Fourier analysis is that we can take an arbitrary function in 1D. Yeah, we're only looking at 1D for now. We can take an arbitrary function and represent it as an infinite sum of sine waves with varying frequencies. So if we look at that example, here we have a sine wave, yeah? And here we have a sine wave where we increase the frequency by 3 and we decrease the frequency also by 3, yeah? So it's the amplitude is smaller and the frequency is higher, yeah? Obviously it's 3 times. If you count, then you will see that it's 3 times. And we do the same with 5 and 7 and 9, yeah? So you see we get sine waves, yeah, which are faster and faster, yeah, but also the amplitude gets smaller and smaller. And if we sum up the sine waves, yeah, so here we sum the first 2, the first 3, the first 4, the first 5, you will see the surprising thing that this converges to such a box function here. Or to put it the other way around, yeah, if we start with such a function, yeah, even such a function like this one, yeah, can be represented obviously by a sum of such sine curves. Yeah, And this is not smooth and so on, yeah? But it can be represented by such a sum of sine curves, yeah? And this is the observation of Fourier, yeah? We can take an arbitrary function and then find out which sine waves we have to add so that we can represent that function. And this is called Fourier transformation. Yeah, we take an arbitrary function in image space. Yeah, so because we are in computer graphics, we say it's in image space. Others do it on audio signals, for instance. Yeah, then the axis would be time. Yeah, but it's for us, it's image space. Yeah, so we take an arbitrary function, and then we compute the frequencies of the sine waves that we have to add to represent that function. And what we get is what we can call a spectrum. So it's a distribution of frequencies. Yeah? Which frequency do we need, or how strong do we need a particular frequency to represent that function? And we can transform this function f of x to such a spectrum f of omega, yeah, now capital F. And this is called Fourier transformation, and we can also do that backwards. If we have such a spectrum, we can compute backwards the original function. Yeah, so that's invertible. And here we see such an example. Yeah, so obviously the simplest thing we can do is to try to represent a sine wave. Yeah, so if we take that sine function, yeah, and we make a Fourier analysis, yeah, obviously we only need one sine function to represent that with a particular frequency. But now what you can see is that this function here also has an offset of one. Yeah, this offset will be represented by a sine wave with frequency zero, yeah, or with infinite wavelength. So it's a constant function. Yeah, so we need that one, a sine wave with frequency zero, and we need the sine wave with that particular frequency. And if you look at the spectrum, you see we have here at zero, we have that peak, that's the offset, the one. And here we have a peak, that's the frequency of the sine wave, yeah? And there's also a negative peak. And yeah, this is what we should accept for now, yeah, that these in our representation that we use here, that really depends on the community, in the representation that we will use here, these spectra are always symmetric. And so for every positive frequency, we also here have the same one with a negative frequency. Yeah, let's simply accept that one. Yeah, the real content is in the positive half. You will see in a minute, yeah, why we use that representation. Okay, yeah, so yeah, that's quite interesting, because now we have a function, and here in the spectrum we can clearly see which frequency is dominant in that image. Yeah, so for our checkerboard, for instance, yeah, if we do that Fourier analysis in the front, we will have a rather low frequency, yeah, because our checkerboards are white, yeah, so the change from black to white, they are very far apart, yeah, so we will have a peak very close to here, yeah, and the further we go to the back, the higher the frequency becomes, yeah, so this peak goes to the moves away from that, from the zero, yeah, and the frequency gets larger and larger. Yeah, so with that tool, we can sort of measure what is the oscillation, yeah, what is the frequency also in our texture. And of course, that does not only work for sine waves, but also, for instance, for this pulse wave here. Yeah, that's exactly this example. If we have something like this, yeah, would have an image like this, yeah, and that, in fact, now would be our checkerboard, right? Always change black to white, yeah, at constant distances, yeah, then the spectrum here looks like this. And you remember, yeah, we represented it this way. It's a sine plus sine 3x over 3, sine 5x over 5, etc. So each of these terms here is one peak in that spectrum. Yeah, so for instance, that peak, I think, is the sine 5x, so 5 is the frequency, Yeah, and this is the amplitude, and you see with increasing frequency, the amplitude goes down. Yeah, and this is exactly this what we see here. Yeah, so the amplitude of that frequency goes down with one over the frequency. Yeah, and you see that spectrum here has clear spikes. Yeah, it's not something continuous, but in that example has spikes. But for a general function like that one, yeah, that's now an arbitrary function. You see there's even quite some noise on it. Yeah, maybe it's from a picture, a line of a picture taken with a normal camera. And if we do the Fourier transform, yeah, we get this image here. And you see it always has this shape, yeah? So most information sort of is concentrated in the lower frequencies. Obviously here we have some peak, yeah? That's a frequency that's hidden in here. Maybe it's something, yeah, that if you look at the distance of these peaks, they always seem to have a similar distance. Maybe that's that peak that shows up here. Yeah, I don't know, that's just a guess. Probably not, that should be a lower frequency. Yeah, but it allows us to sort of analyze the image, that representation. And now we can also do a few things with that. Yeah, I told you we can do the computation in both directions. Yeah, so we can take that function and compute the Fourier transform from it, or we can take that one, yeah, and transfer it back to the original image. And before we can do that, we can play a little bit around. So, for instance, what we could do is that we here now cut off all high frequencies. Yeah. So here we set a limit. Yeah, and cut off all the frequencies here on the right. Yeah, to see how they contribute to the final image, for instance, and then transform back to the original image. And what you see is, Now this is the original. Yeah, and now if we cut off the high frequencies, now look at the top, yeah, you see that we get a very similar image. Yeah, but obviously all these fine oscillations have been removed. Yeah, that's exactly what we expect. Yeah, because we've cut off all the sine waves, yeah, that have very fast fine oscillations. Yeah. So we remove Essentially, we remove noise, yeah, with that. We reduce the signal to the sort of important part, yeah, which is here in the inner part, yeah. And we can do that even further if we remove even more frequencies. Yeah, we end up with that one, and that's now we have an even further smoothed curve than here. And in fact, now we can make a guess what this peak comes from, yeah, because by the new filtering, it is removed. And yeah, obviously it's these oscillations here, yeah, these fine oscillations, because with that, they have been removed, yeah. Okay, so yeah, with this Fourier transform, yeah, now we can argument about a function, what's the frequency content. And yeah, probably you can already imagine a little bit these, it's in particular these high frequencies that result in errors, yeah, or that will generate aliasing in our final images. And we can also kind of filter our functions, yeah, or smoothen our function by removing such high frequencies, yeah. And here we get versions now of our texture or of our image that are still contain the major content, yeah, but they're much smoother. Okay, so why does that help us now to understand aliasing? And now we need another observation, and that is the following. So let's look again at our function here and its spectrum. Yeah, that's the Fourier transform of this image. Yeah, we've seen that quite often now. And now we want to describe the sampling process when we take this texture in the upper left and apply it as a texture during rasterization. Because what happens then is, yeah, with our pixel grid, if we only sample at the pixel centers, yeah, we sample this texture at arbitrary positions. Yeah, we've seen that in the images before. So we can kind of simulate that. Yeah, we take the original image, and now sampling means is that in this example, I've simply said every 10th value or left every 10th value original, and all the other values in between I've set to zero. Yeah, so we sample this particular function at a certain distance. Yeah, in that example, I sampled at every 10th, texel, sort of. Yeah, I sampled that signal. And if we compute the Fourier transform of that one, yeah, which is a weird looking function, but we can still compute the Fourier transform, we get this result here. And this looks probably a little bit surprising, yeah, but it's a well-known effect of sampling, yeah, that we get a Fourier spectrum that looks like this. And if we look at that a little bit closer, we realize, I mean, okay, there are some scaling issues here now, but besides that, obviously, we here have the original function, yeah, that's the spectrum of the original function, and then we have in parallel lots of copies of that, yeah, that repeat, yeah, it's just copies that are repeated at the same distance. Yeah, so these are all identical copies of that one in the center. Okay, that's a property. It can be explained. Yeah, those of you who know Fourier transform better, yeah, it's this like convolution in one space is multiplication in the other space and so on. That can be rather easily derived. And the interesting thing is if we increase the sampling frequency, yeah, here now I take every 5th sample instead of every 10th. Yeah, so I halved the sampling distance. Yeah, then the spectrum changed in that there are still such copies. Yeah, but they get further apart. Yeah, and if I would half them further, yeah, these copies would even further go out. Yeah. And that also means, yeah, the finer we sample, yeah, the more these copies go to the outside, yeah, and the more similar our spectrum becomes to the original, yeah, because all the artifacts, yeah, happen in the high frequencies, yeah, and the further they go out, the higher the frequency becomes, and the less important sort of they are. Okay, that's a very weak argument, yeah, but it's roughly like this. Yeah, or at least the more similar the spectra are. Okay, good. So now we are at a point that we can maybe a little bit understand where these new frequencies come from. The problem is the following. If we have a signal or a texture that has a spectrum that looks like this, and we have a given and we sample that signal with a given frequency, yeah, with a given distance. Essentially, yeah, this means we select a particular line in our image, yeah, because there the pixel sampling samples the texture at a given pixel distance. Yeah. So if we sample that function and look and make a Fourier transform, yeah, so this is the original texture, and now we sample it here with our pixel grid, and from the result we make the Fourier transform, we get this here. Yeah, we get these multiple copies. And now there is a range here where these spectra overlap. And what does that mean? That means now that a high frequency of this copy, yeah, here for instance, becomes visible as a lower frequency or is mixed with the lower frequencies of this copy. And they are simply added up, so we cannot separate them anymore. So a high frequency of this copy, yeah, becomes visible as a lower frequency. And these are exactly these weird patterns that we have in the background. Suddenly we see new details, new squares or new stripes, yeah, and these rings and so forth. That have a frequency that does not correspond to the real texture, but this comes exactly from these copies here. and it's not possible to separate them anymore. Yeah, if they are summed up, yeah, we cannot see, yeah, we cannot filter that out anymore. Okay, so what can we do? I mean, one observation is that if we increase sampling, yeah, obviously the copies go further apart. So in that case, if we sample finer, yeah, then here these copies don't overlap anymore. And what we can do is that we apply this filter that we've seen before. You remember here? What we did is that we take the original image, yeah, and apply such a filter here, and then reconstruct the original image. And what we can do here is that we sample the image, then we get this Fourier spectrum, but from the result, we can sort of imagine we can still reconstruct the original, yeah, by just applying that filter, and then we have the original signal again, and we can reconstruct it. Yeah, so in that case, all the information from the original texture is still contained. Nothing got lost, and we have no aliasing. But that would mean, yeah, we need finer sampling. We would have to increase our pixel resolution, which we cannot. Yeah, we cannot build in new pixels on our screen on demand, yeah, somewhere. We can buy a more expensive screen, yeah, and then the aliasing range will maybe move up a little bit, but it won't go away. So, what can we do? The best way is that we say, okay, we cannot display this texture on the current resolution of our pixel grid, so we adapt our texture so that aliasing goes away and we still see the important detail. And how can we modify our texture, or what would be the best way? Ah, by the way, I forgot that. The aliasing appears obviously for all frequencies that are below a certain frequency here, omega. Yep. And this frequency depends on our sampling distance. Yeah. So that's essentially half the distance between these copies. And the distance between these copies directly depends on the sampling distance. And yes, so if we have frequencies beyond that frequency, which by the way is called the Nyquist frequency, yeah, then aliasing will appear. And that on the other hand means if our texture doesn't have frequencies beyond the Nyquist frequency, we are fine. Yeah, or at least in theory, we can reconstruct everything and we won't see aliasing other frequencies appear as new ones. And this is then also what we in general can do. We take our original texture and we remove all the frequencies above Nyquist. Yeah. Now the problem is that the Nyquist frequency depends on the ratio of sizes between texture and pixels. So it's not constant for the entire image. Yeah. It's really for every pixel, this Nyquist frequency is different. So we will see in a minute how we can solve that. But in general, yeah, we apply a low pass filter to our image. That means we take the spectrum, we make a Fourier transform, cut off all the frequencies beyond Nyquist, transform back. Yeah, this will give a smoother texture. Yeah, you remember that's exactly this step here. Here, yeah, smoothen the image. Yeah, here we cut off high frequencies up to 0.2, here up to 0.1, and we get even smoother and smoother versions. And now these smoother textures, yeah, they are slightly blurred, but at least they don't generate aliasing anymore. Yeah, and we've solved that problem, at least in theory, because that's not a practical approach. Yeah, we cannot for every pixel in our texture, maybe in the pixel shader, do a Fourier transform of the entire texture and then cut off frequencies and do the Fourier transform back. That would be extremely costly. Yeah, so we have to find a better solution for that. So remember, cutting off high frequency means smoothing. That means we need to smooth the image, and we need to be able to smooth the image, with varying degree. Yeah. So depending on the Nyquist frequency, yeah, see here we have a small Nyquist frequency, so we have it more blurred than here. Yeah. Okay, so here we have no Nyquist at all. Yeah, and but how much we smooth really depends on the Nyquist frequency, and thus on is varying with the current from pixel to pixel. Okay, so just a short remark on image filtering. Yeah, maybe some of you are not immediately aware of what that is. Image filtering is very simple. Yeah, because if we want to smooth our images, yeah, we will apply filtering. And the idea of filtering is that we take an image, and for every pixel, we replace its value by a weighted average of its neighbors. And the simplest filter is such a 3x3 box filter, and it is represented like this. And this means that every pixel we replace by the average of its 3x3 neighborhood. Yeah, so we take the pixel and its 8 direct neighbors, and we average these values. And you can imagine this results in making the image blurrier, unsharper. And another filter, for instance, is this tent filter here. Yeah, so you see the weights vary a little bit, and this mask here is called the filter kernel. Yeah, that tells us how that filter looks like. And probably the best filter to smooth images turned out to be a Gaussian filter. Yeah, so that's a filter that has maximum weight in the center, and then with a Gaussian is reduced towards the boundary. And now the Gaussian has the problem that it's larger than zero everywhere, so we have to cut it at some point, because we don't want to have an infinitely large filter. We want to have a filter of size maybe 5x5, yeah, which is still computationally not cheap but doable. Yeah, and so we have to cut off at 5x5, and we have to select a proper size. Yeah, so you know you can change the size or the width of the Gaussian using the standard deviation. And so that would be, for instance, an example for a good 5x5 Gaussian filter. So you see the weight in the center is maximal. Yeah, and towards the further we go to the outside, the smaller these weights get. Okay. Yeah, so that's in practice the best filter to smooth images. Okay, oh, sorry, here's something went wrong, but it's still doable. Okay, so that was just a little interlude with what image filtering is. Now, here what we want to do is that we apply such a box filter in frequency space. Yeah, we cut off frequencies beyond Nyquist. And now looking at all these Fourier theory, we can find out that such a box filter in frequency space corresponds, or such a box multiplication in frequency space corresponds to a sinc filter in image space. Sinc is the function sine x over x, and here you can see the corresponding function. So if we look at the center, this looks a little bit like a Gaussian. Yeah, it also has this bell shape, but at some point it even becomes negative, and it also has infinite support. Yeah, so it's infinitely also, it has values larger than zero everywhere, or almost everywhere. Okay. What does that mean? Yeah, just to transfer that back to our case. Essentially, we could take our original texture, filter it with such a sinc function, and then use that filtered version as texture. But now the problem is, depending on the pixel distances, yeah, we need different sinc filters with different width. Yeah, so essentially we would have to do that for every pixel. Filter the entire texture with a corresponding sink, and then we would get an optimal result. And that's not really practical, in particular because the sink has infinite support. So what is done in practice is that we use a Gauss filter, for instance, to filter down these images, but it still means that we need Gauss filters with varying width. Yeah. Okay, good. So we are almost there. Because we still now have the problem, how can we do that practically? Yeah, because we need all these different widths. And the approach now to solve texture aliasing is to do what we call MIP mapping. And the idea now here is the following. So let's assume we have a texture like this one here. Yeah. And now we know at some point we will have texture minification. Yeah. And to avoid texture minification, now we need blurred versions or filtered, smoothed versions of our texture. And of course, now we cannot for every smooth size, we cannot enumerate textures. So what we do is that we compute variants of our textures that are filtered with varying sizes. And the easiest way to do that is that we simply, from our original texture, generate versions of the textures that have less and less pixels. And to come from here to here, we apply also a filter. Yeah, you can also apply filters to generate reduced versions of your texture. So now we take the large texture, 256 by 256, and then we generate a version with 128 by 128. Yeah, and because it's smaller, it will have less higher frequencies. Yeah, so the high frequencies must be removed by making a smaller version of that image. And we do not only once, but multiple times. Yeah, so we also go to 64 by 64. To 32 by 32, to 16 by 16, and so forth. Yeah. So here at the end, we end up with a single pixel. And this is what we call a pyramid, an image pyramid. Yeah. Because if we take these textures and put them in such an order, you see that it looks like a pyramid. Yeah. Okay. So from our texture, we store multiple versions with different resolution and thus with different high frequencies, with reduced high frequencies. And now during rendering, we can on the fly determine if we look up our texture, do we use this texture or this one or this one or this one or this one? Yeah, so we take the texture that for our case is best. It won't be optimal, because usually we will need something in between this one and this one. Yeah, but I mean, it's better than nothing. Okay? Okay, just a short remark. Yeah, how are these MIP map levels normally generated? I mean, I made a big introduction with Gaussian filters and so on. In practice, what is used to downsample these images typically is that we take simple block filters that from a texture take 2 by 2 blocks. Yeah, so they subdivide the texture into 2 by 2 blocks, and then every pixel of the new image contains exactly the average of these four. Yeah, so here we have four, probably you cannot see it here on the slide, so these are 4 pixels inside here, and they are replaced by 1 pixel with the average color. So this texture here only has a quarter of the resolution of that one. Yeah, so the size is the same, but this is only 1 pixel, and here it's 4 pixels. And then we do that for the next one, and for the next one, and so forth, And then we get here a lower resolution texture. Yeah, this gives us the transition from here to here, and then we do the same again from here to here, and from here to here, and so forth. And this is how this pyramid can be built. Of course, we can also use better filters, maybe Gaussians, that also take a larger kernel into account. But for now, that simple box filter will do. Okay, so here's a result how such a MIP map could look like. Yeah, let's again start with our checkerboard texture, 8 by 8. Yeah, all pixels black and white, every other pixel black or white. And now the surprising thing, maybe already the first MIP map level looks like this. Yeah. So it's a 4x4 texture with 50% gray. And if you think about it, yeah, it's the only way that we can represent such a checkerboard in a reasonable manner in a 4x4 texture. Yeah, because every pixel in that texture here, yeah, represents here such a 2x2 grid. Yeah, it contains two black and two white pixels. Yeah. So if we would make that black, yeah, then all the white is gone. If we make it white, then all the black is gone. Yeah. We can try to replace it by a checkerboard that only has 4x4 pixels. But of course, that doesn't make sense, yeah? Because that would mean that in the distance, our texture squares get larger, yeah? That's also not what we want. So the only thing we can do is that we replace it by such a gray texture here, and then the other levels are also gray, yeah? That's at least the good news, yeah? From here to here, nothing gets lost anymore. But from here to here, for that very extreme example, yeah, the appearance changes quite a bit. Okay, so yeah, we take our texture, we build our MIP map pyramid, and let me emphasize again, this is an academic example. Yeah, for a real world texture, it's by far not that bad. We can see it in a minute, in the demo again. So now we have that texture stack, yeah, and now at runtime, when we are in a pixel shader, essentially, and we want to read the texture, yeah, we have to, and in fact, we don't have to do that. OpenGL or WebGL does that for us. Yeah, it's automatically selected which level of that pyramid for my current texture read is the best. And how is that done? Yeah, it's often rather magic, and yeah, often special properties of pixel shaders that make it possible to even compute derivatives on certain variables. I won't detail on that very much because it's really also application dependent, but we can imagine it in a way that a ratio between pixel and texel size is computed. And you remember, if that ratio is 1, that's probably the last moment when we take the maximum resolution texture, yeah? And beyond that, we will have to start going to lower resolution textures, and this can be computed using that formula, the logarithm with a basis of 2 of p. Yeah, this tells us which texture in our texture stack we should use. And then for practical reasons, often there's also some bias added, yeah, that allows to control a little bit, yeah, or to adjust, make fine adjustment, which also depends on texture content, for instance. Yeah, sometimes it's better to delay that MIP mapping sort of a little bit, yeah, because the texture content is well behaved, and we don't get too much blur. Yeah, and if we choose that level wrongly, yeah, if we in general choose a 2-coarse MIP map level, that means L bias is too big. What we get is that we don't have aliasing, but we always use the too blurred texture, yeah, or too low resolution texture. So in general, our textures will be blurry and unsharp. And if we choose a too fine MIP map level, we get aliasing. Yeah, and ideally we have to find the sweet spot between blurry textures and aliasing. Yeah. And the optimal choice, as I said, depends on the texture, but usually or in WebGL, this L bias is simply 0. Yeah. Okay, and now this is a result. Yeah, and I must admit it's not doesn't really look convincing. Yeah. So what we see here now is our checkerboard. So this is the range where we have the maximum MIP map level. Yeah, so we can see all the checkerboards, it's fine. Yeah, so here, obviously, we still, or it starts again with aliasing. Yeah, so we see here again these patterns. In the background, obviously, we see no aliasing, yeah, because it's flat gray, yeah, which is fine. And we can also see that we have a hard transition between this and this, yeah, because as we do it right now, we have to decide which MIPMAP level to use, yeah, and when we switch from the from this level to this level, yeah, we have that hard transition between these two. And in that case, this transition is very well visible. Yeah, and these other MIPMAP levels then here when we interpolate or when we, the transition is not visible because they all look the same. Okay, and to make that transition a little bit less visible, what is usually done is that L, that tells us the MIPMAP level to use, is not an integer number, but it's a floating point value or a real number. So we can take it to interpolate between the two MIPMAP levels. In fact, yeah, if we have L of here 2.5, yeah, we are just in between level 3 and level 2, then we read the texture here and we read this texture and we interpolate between the two. Yeah, depending on the MIPMAP level that we found by this formula. And this is what we call trilinear interpolation, yeah, because now we make a bilinear interpolation in this texture level, a bilinear interpolation in this level, and then we interpolate between these two to get the final value. Yeah? But what that means now is that this hard transition disappears, yeah, and we kind of in some range blend between the real checkerboard and the gray checkerboard, or between the different levels, yeah, and so this at least this hard transition disappears, yeah, and here we see an example where that works maybe a little better. No MIP mapping, and here we have MIP mapping. You can see in the background, yeah, it just goes to gray or some bluish gray in that example, and this looks now looks much better. And we can, I have that here. And we can also try that here now. And I can change, yeah, I will show that in a minute what these means, what these mean. But this would now be MIP mapping and a trilinear interpolation. And you see now in the background, everything is gray. Yeah. So that works nice, but you also see, yeah, that obviously we still have aliasing here. Yeah, but it disappears again. It's only at the transition. Yeah, I think we can even see some aliasing here already. Yeah, but here I think it's very noticeable. And if we make nearest MIPMAP, it's exactly the range where this transition happens. Yeah, it's probably here is the transition. Yeah, and due to the trilinear interpolation, still some aliasing is sort of interpolated in. Yeah, but nevertheless, I mean, oops. Yeah, if we look at that, you still see these aliasing effects. Yeah, but I mean, this is the competitor. Okay, and the checkerboard is really a very extreme example. So if we take something more practical, let's take that one, let's mirror it, and let's make nearest. I think you can still see the aliasing in the background. Can you? Yeah. Oh, wow. On the projector, it's better visible than on my screen. Yeah, probably very bad. And if we turn on MIP mapping, yeah, then things are fine. Yeah, and now here you see we don't see aliasing at the transition anymore, which here was still clearly visible, yeah, but here for such a texture, this is not an issue anymore. Okay, good. So how did we do that? MIP mapping is very important. It's directly supported by WebGL. It explains one of the parameters that I didn't explain up to now in the function GLTextImage. And in fact, it's that parameter here. And it means that for every image, for every texture, you cannot only load one version, but multiple versions. Yeah? And for each MIPMAP level, you can upload one version. And we always uploaded level zero, so the numbering is always a little bit difficult. In my examples on the slides, level zero is the 1x1 texture, and it gets larger the higher the resolution gets. Here it's just the other way around. Zero is the finest resolution level, and then it goes upwards. And now we can upload multiple versions of our texture for the different MIPMAP levels. Yeah? And then in the pixel shader, okay, that comes later. Okay, so that's the complicated way. That would mean that we don't have to filter our images ourselves, to generate that image stack. But in fact, there's a function that is called generate MIPMAP. Yeah, and there you have to upload the highest resolution level, and then you call MIPMAP, and then all the other levels are generated automatically. Yeah, this is the way to go. Generate MIPMAP, and we are done. And then we have to tell WebGL to also use this MIPMAP. Yeah, and to control that, there are two parameters which can be set via GL text parameter. And you see the first one is for texture magnification. That's what we spoke about in the very beginning, where we can only use nearest neighbor or linear filtering. And the second one is for texture minification. And yeah, this is where we apply textures. And you see for texture magnification, we have the two options, nearest and linear. This is for magnification. And for minification, the probably best level is linear interpolation within the texture, and then linear interpolation between the MIPMAPs. That's trilinear. This one is 2D linear, this one is 1D linear. Yeah, altogether is trilinear interpolation. But we can also take nearest neighbor in between the MIPMAPs or within the texture. So probably this is always the way to go. Yeah, sometimes maybe if you have a checkerboard, you want to have nearest within the texture, but linear between the MIPMAPs. Yeah, so these probably also make sense, but normally trilinear is the best one. Yeah, and these are also the options that we've seen here. For texture magnification, we have nearest and linear, and for minification, we have these, or if we take nearest and linear, then MIP mapping is turned off. Yeah? That's on the slides here. Yeah, so that also, these two options are also possible for minification. Sorry. Okay, good. So, up to now, maybe some of you already wondered about that. I made an argument starting with 1D signals, yeah? But our textures are 2D, obviously, yeah? And if we look at these images here, for instance, we can imagine maybe that here in the background, essentially, yeah, we always looked at scan lines, but if we would look at scan rows, the frequency along a row is probably very different than that on a line. Yeah, so which MIPMAP level to choose? Yeah, we have two different sizes of our squares in the image. In these examples, they won't look like this here, but in fact, they will look like this. Yeah, so they will be lengthy. Yeah, and so if I look in this direction, I will have other frequencies than if I look in this direction. Yeah, so shouldn't we consider this? And yes, we should consider that. And to make an argument here, it makes sense to look at what we call the pixel footprint. And here the idea is the following. Up to now, we always said, okay, we have this texture, yeah, these squares on our checkerboard, and we look how they project into our image. But of course, we can also do it the other way around. We can also project our pixel pattern to the texture. We can take, for instance, for a pixel, the four corners, and compute the corresponding texture coordinates, and then we get what we call the footprint of our pixel in the texture. And this footprint tells us that this is the region of the texture that is represented in a particular pixel on our screen. And essentially that means this footprint, one approach would be that we say the average value of the texture within that footprint, this should become the color of that one pixel. So we somehow have to average our texture over the footprint of the corresponding pixel. This region of the pixel becomes of the texture becomes visible in the pixel. So if it would be a checkerboard, we could say, okay, we have something like 1, 2, 3, maybe 3.5 black pixels, and 1, 2, also 3.5 white pixels. So on average, we are gray. It's kind of we turn around the perspective, and look at the perspective from the texture and which part of the texture is mapped to a pixel. This is the footprint. And now MIP mapping can be explained quite easily. If we have such a footprint here, and we say this is level 3 of our texture, obviously the texels are smaller than pixels, so we have to expect aliasing. But if we look at the later levels here, for instance, our texels have roughly the size of our pixel footprint. So if we have that pixel footprint, that's probably the right texture level to use. And this one is too blurry. And this one, here we still have to expect aliasing, but here we are roughly fine. So we can also argument with a size of our pixel footprint. And now this somehow assumes that our pixel footprint is sort of squarish. But of course, it can also have a very different shape, like here in the background. Here the pixel sizes will be elongated. And now the question is, if we have that pixel footprint, should we use this picture, this texture in this direction? The spacing would be fine, but of course, in this length, not. Or should we take this level? that fits horizontally. But now we have a very blurry, if we only look at the sizes, this pixel footprint is much smaller than this pixel. So now here we get blur, and here we get aliasing. And in between, we probably get both. and that's bad. So if we look at such an example for a distant pixel, we will have a pixel footprint like this. Very long and thin. All these texels should be summed up in one pixel value. But it's long and thin in this direction. And if we now choose level 0, which the height of the footprint would suggest, then we get a very blurry image in horizontal direction. Because in horizontal direction, then we have far too much blur. And if we choose level 3, then in horizontal direction, we have a sharp image, but we have aliasing in the vertical direction. And if we use levels in between, we have both. In one direction, aliasing, in the other, blurring. And that's not very helpful. So we can try to find a solution. And one is anisotropic filtering. Isotropic means that we say our pixel footprint is almost like a square. So if we have our MIP map, it's rather simple to find one that has pixels that have roughly the same shape as our footprint, or texels that have roughly the same shape as our footprint. But anisotropic means that the footprint can be long and thin and maybe even rotated. And one option to at least improve a little bit is to use another way to compute the MIP maps. And what you see here is an anisotropic MIP map. And here the idea is that every image, we do not only downscale in both dimensions. So here along the diagonal, that would be the normal MIP map. But we also scale down only in one dimension. So here we halve only the width, then we get this one. If we halve the width again, we get here and here, But we have also here, yeah, so here the width is quartered and the height is halved. Yeah, so we have all put power of two subsamplings available, and they can be aligned in a texture very elegantly. Yeah, so the final texture has exactly twice the width and twice the height of the original texture, so that can store very compactly. Yeah, and now in this here, we can find much better MIPMAP levels to account for something like this here. Yeah, such a footprint. Yeah, we will probably use one of these textures here. Yeah, because they are only squeezed in height but not in width. Okay, so this is called an anisotropic MIPMAP. Yeah. So that would work in this case, but probably not in this case, or less in this case, because yeah, these filters for the anisotropic MIPMAP are rectangles, but axis-aligned rectangles and not rotated. Yeah, so in many cases we can get better results, but there are also cases where it won't work. Yeah, and if we rotate the texture, the checkerboard, for instance, then it will work less. Yeah, that's also weird. So what's the solution? We could extend our MIPMAP even further by also adding maybe a third dimension for rotation, so that we can pre-filter all different types of shapes, of possible shapes. But yeah, at some point that becomes too expensive. And what the typical way today is to solve that problem is that MIP mapping is combined with sampling. And that means the footprint, when accessing a texture, the shape of the footprint is also computed. And then the texture is not read by only one sample into a particular MIP map, but by multiple samples. And with these multiple samples now, the shape can be addressed just by positioning the samples within the pixel footprint. And for each of these samples, we take MIP mapping. Yeah, or not we, but the hardware decides about that usually, or the OpenGL. And samples, the positions of the samples account for the general shape. Yeah, and for each of these samples, then MIP mapping is used. That's a kind of compromise. It's an expensive compromise, because it means we need four times as many samples. If we have fourfold sampling for anisotropic texturing, or maybe eight, that's a parameter that can be selected in the driver. It's expensive. That means if you go into the settings of your GPU, for instance, you will quickly find a way to select which anisotropic filtering method is to be used and how many samples, because that has impact on performance, quite some impact. Yeah, and that should only be chosen if you really need it, because it makes things generally slower. Yeah? So choose only if necessary. But that's the way then, how in the end, also for the anisotropic case, good results can be achieved. Here's an image that hopefully shows that a little bit. This is standard MIP mapping with trilinear filtering. And here we can see in the background, I mean, we have no aliasing, but obviously more blur than necessary. Yeah. And this is exactly because of this anisotropy feature, that too fast, or it has to use a coarse MIP map level already here, to avoid aliasing in this direction. But in this direction, this generates a blur, and with anisotropic filtering, you can see that the texture remains crisp and sharp also in the background, and no aliasing is there. But again, the price for this one is significant. Yeah, even on modern GPUs, it's quite expensive to use that anisotropic filtering. Okay, that's it, just in time today. And next week, we will then speak about the end of the graphics pipeline, so to say. How do we generate all these models, all these triangle meshes that we put into our OpenGL pipeline? Where do all these triangles come from, and how do we position objects in our scene and so forth? And this will be next Monday. Thank you.